Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. What do you think about when you look at the moon, that bright, beautiful object in the night sky?
Personally, the moon is a source of light and hope and strength related to our humanity and water. My name is Annette Lee. Itakwe Oyasin to all my relations.
Annette is a professor of astronomy and physics at St. Cloud State University in Minnesota. She's Lakota. Her husband is Ojibwe. As a scientist, Annette thinks about the moon in one way.
Western science is founded on measurement, data collection, the scientific method, prediction, right? And this is all really great. This has taken us far.
We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, for example. We just did a whole episode about that called Destination Moon. Scientists are studying moon rocks. They are learning more about the origins of the moon. But in her Native American traditions, the moon holds a different meaning for Annette. It's tied to keeping time, to seasons and ceremonies. Every month has a moon named for it. For example, in Ojibwe, the moon in May is
Zababaga Gizis. Gizis is the word for sun, but the Dibik Gizis is the night sun, the moon. So Gizis is always at the end of the word. Zababaga refers to the moment when you have the bud on the branch and the petals, the shell of the bud, first start to crack open, like almost like an egg, and that green newborn leaf starts to push through that moment of birthing. That is Zababaga.
For Annette, these two different ways of looking at the moon are not incompatible. An elder once told her it was two-eyed seeing, where you look at the world in both the indigenous and Western way. And seeing with both eyes gives you more perspective.
That there's these other spiritual forces out there, and so we have relationships with them that are key to our survival. And it's not just about gathering food, it's a spiritual survival. And the spiritual survival rests at having this relationship with something that's bigger than ourselves, but yet we are a part of.
The moon lights up our nights. It influences the ocean's tides. It stabilizes the Earth's tilt, which is responsible for our seasons. Without the moon, our lives here on Earth would be very, very different. So on this episode, we're paying homage to all the moon does to shape our existence. Our first story is about the moon and mental health. For centuries, writers, doctors, and scientists believed that the moon could affect our moods and cause erratic behavior. The word lunacy has its root in lunar. And maybe you're rolling your eyes right now. I know, it's an idea that's been considered to be nonsense for a long time. But reporter Liz Tung talked with two scientists whose research on a devastating mental illness brought them to the moon.
Our story begins with a guy named Michael.
Good morning.
He asked that we not use his last name because his story gets pretty personal. Anyway, Michael and I talked on the phone the day after the 4th of July.
Well, tired. Last night was quite an adventure.
That's because Michael works with horses. And as it turns out, horses do not like fireworks.
They get really anxious, act out, do a lot of things, get themselves in trouble.
In fact, Michael spent the entire night making house calls. He didn't sleep a wink, which is very unusual for Michael. That's because for him, getting a good night's sleep can be a matter of life and death.
Really, the whole sleep-wake cycle is so pivotal to your biochemical processes.
Michael's journey to figuring that out began in his early 30s. That's when he was diagnosed with rapid cycling bipolar disorder. More on that in a sec. Up until that point, his life was good. He had a job, a family, but then things went south. He got divorced, was laid off from his job, and then he got in a serious car accident.
And got a severe concussion and what I now know is a big head injury. And after that, I started not being able to sleep.
Michael had always been a pretty regular sleeper, but at this point, it was like all the things that had once anchored his life disappeared. He had no job to get up for in the morning, no wife and kids to spend time with. And because he was short on money, Michael had to move from his family's waterfront home into a trailer that belonged to a friend.
I had no money. I was unemployed, just squalid conditions, just absolutely nothing.
The trailer got almost zero sunlight, and soon Michael's sleep schedule had gone totally haywire. He'd sleep 12 hours one night and then barely at all the next. He stopped seeing friends, found himself drinking heavily, and then he started having massive mood swings.
I mean, you can be in the deep, deep depths of depression and think, I'm going to close my eyes and I'm not going to wake up in the morning. And all of a sudden you wake up when the sun rises, the birds are singing, and you're like, wow, where have I been?
Michael had no idea what was going on. All he knew was that his life seemed to be falling apart.
I was in a severe downward spiral.
Eventually, Michael went to the doctor and was diagnosed with rapid cycling bipolar disorder. With bipolar, people experience shifts between two extremes, depression and mania. With regular bipolar, that happens maybe 2 to 3 times a year. But with rapid cycling, it can happen a lot faster. Michael found himself switching several times a month between depression and mania, and it was hell.
And it was hard. It was frustrating. And sometimes I had to withdraw entirely and just go walk out in the woods and scream and, you know, get the energy, the pace, you know, a lot. And then it would pass.
Michael's doctor prescribed him a string of medications, but he says they just seemed to make things worse. And Michael was losing hope of ever figuring out what was going on with him. So he did the one thing he could think of to try and figure this thing out.
I took out a journal and I started to write down data. And all I could think of to do is write down when you go to sleep, when you got up, what'd you eat that day? What was the weather like? What was the moon phase? You know, all these things. I thought, something's going on here.
By 2004, Michael had hit an all-time low. He was suicidal, had grown psychotic from the lack of sleep. So he did the last thing he could think of to save himself. He checked into a local hospital in Seattle.
And he presented to me a sleep log that he had kept over the previous 4 months because he noted that his sleep-wake cycle had a very clear pattern to it associated with his mood swings.
That's Dr. David Avery, the inpatient psychiatrist who was assigned to take care of Michael. And what David saw in Michael's log was a very strange but very regular sleeping pattern.
His sleep was such that every 15 days, he would sleep for only about 0 to 2 hours per night.
2 hours of sleep and be fine. It wouldn't bother me.
And during that, he would become manic. Then 7 days after,
when I had no energy at all,
he would sleep for a long period of time and be depressed.
I'd go to bed at like 6 in the afternoon and get up and struggle to get up at 6 the next day.
And that pattern continued, alternating between short sleep and long sleep over a 4 month period.
I knew keeping the data that, wait a minute, why is this happening? There's a swing going on here.
It was so regular that David, the psychiatrist, figured there had to be some external force causing Michael's sleep pattern to oscillate from week to week, back and forth, from short sleep to long sleep. But what that force could be, he had no idea. As it turned out, across the country in Bethesda, Maryland, another researcher was working on the very same question. A retired psychiatrist and researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health named Tom Ware.
For many years, I have done research on mood disorders and sleep and circadian rhythms.
Tom is being modest here. He's a world-leading expert on circadian rhythms and mood disorders. In fact, he, along with another colleague, were the ones who first discovered seasonal affective disorder, or SAD.
And we developed light treatment for winter depression.
Tom first got interested in rapid cycling bipolar disorder in the early 70s. That's when he first started seeing patients with this unusual form of illness.
The changes were very dramatic. Somebody who had been sort of quiet and withdrawn for weeks would just gradually become very outgoing and bubbly and enthusiastic and get really busy and just even look different, you know?
It was like the most extreme version of an illness that deals in extremes. So Tom thinks to himself, if I ever want to understand bipolar or mood disorders in general, this is what I need to be studying. So he decides to pull back and begin with a broad view.
So I was sort of, at the beginning, not really pursuing a specific hypothesis, but I was kind of more like a 19th century naturalist.
He enlisted about 20 patients, and instead of just looking at one thing or trying some specific intervention, he looked at everything. Their diet, their sleep patterns, their hormones, motor activity, blood work, and, of course, their moods.
I was convinced that there were some very powerful biological forces at play in that illness, but we knew so little about it that I thought we should just keep an open mind.
His hope was that by tracking everything, they'd be able to see if a pattern was emerging, the thing that was causing people to switch from mania to depression and back. Gathering the data took a lot of time. But in the 90s, Tom made a discovery that started getting to the root of what causes the switch between moods in people with rapid cycling bipolar disorder.
It turns out if someone is depressed in this way and you simply ask them to stay awake all night, about two-thirds of the time, that person will become manic.
In 1996, Tom and his colleagues released a study showing that lack of sleep was the number one predictor of rapid cycling subjects switch from depression to mania. They'd already known that sleep disturbances are a part of bipolar disorder. Depression meant lots of sleep, mania hardly any. But what this study showed about sleep was that
it's not just a symptom. It's also part of the cause of the illness.
Let me repeat that. Sleep disturbances weren't just a symptom of bipolar. They were part of the cause. It was a landmark finding. The study's been cited nearly 200 times and led to changes in how bipolar disorder is treated. Sleep is now considered an important part of managing symptoms. But for Tom, even that wasn't enough. It didn't answer the question of the ultimate cause.
Some of these cycles seemed so precise that it was hard to understand how a purely biological process could produce that degree of precision. And I started thinking, you know, is there some external signal that's kind of controlling the time of this?
If you think about our wake and sleep schedule, night and day, you start thinking about the sun and the moon. That's what we've used for centuries to mark time. So Tom started looking at the moon.
There's always been a popular belief that the moon is somehow affecting human behavior.
A belief, sure, but one that's mostly been debunked by science. And in fact, when Tom looked at the data, he couldn't find a connection, at least at first. The moon and sleep cycles did not seem to correspond with the moon's phases. So Tom kept on thinking. When he had time, he'd take the data out from the 20 or so patients that he'd started following back in the 1970s. He'd pore over the cycling patterns and then put it away again. This went on for more than three decades.
I think it really took years and years. I'd hesitate to put a number on it.
Finally, in the 2010s, Tom had a break in the case. He thought, what if these mood cycles did have something to do with the moon, just not in the way he'd thought? All of these past moon studies, they'd looked at people's health and behavior in relation to the moon's light. But it occurred to Tom that thanks to electricity,
you know, we don't get much exposure to moonlight in the modern world. I think most people are not even aware at any particular time, you know, what phase the moon is in.
So we thought, what if there were another kind of lunar cycle influencing people's sleep? So Tom had to think, what else is the moon connected with besides the light in the sky? The answer? The ocean's tides. To help explain how the moon influences the tides, I enlisted astronomer Derek Pitts.
The moon actually pulls the Earth's ocean's water, and it pulls that water towards the moon.
That pull leads to high tides, which happen roughly twice per day. But here's the catch. The sun, the Earth, and the moon are all on their own schedules.
A solar day is the length of time it takes the Earth to rotate on its axis once under the sun.
24 hours. A lunar day, on the other hand, is slightly different.
in that as the Earth rotates on its axis in a solar day, the moon also moves slightly in its orbit around the Earth. So for one point on the Earth to return to the exact same location pointed at the moon, you also have to add the degree to which the moon has moved. So that makes it one lunar day. And that lunar day is 24 hours, 50 minutes, as opposed to just 24 hours for a solar day.
You can think of it like the hands on a watch, with the Earth being the second hand and the moon being the minute hand. It should take 60 ticks for the second hand to align with the minute hand, except that the minute hand is moving too. So every time they line up, it takes one tick more for the second hand to catch up with the minute hand. It takes the Earth an extra 50 minutes every day to catch up with the moon. Now there's one more thing. Twice a month, the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon all line up, causing the very strongest pull on the oceans, which give us the very highest tides, also known as spring tides. It also happens to coincide with the full moon or the new moon. And here's what Tom noticed. His patient's sleep schedules seem to be following the lunar tidal cycle. In the same way that the high tides happened 50 minutes later every day, the time his patients were waking up was also shifting a little later every day.
They would stretch the duration of sleep longer and longer and longer.
During the lowest tides of the month, they might sleep as much as 12 hours a night, until finally...
And then, at a certain point, shift and cause sleep to be very short, again, as the lunar-controlled network would go on around the clock.
The highest tides of the month would hit, and they wouldn't sleep at all, which meant that's when they were most likely to shift into mania. So that was what Tom put together based on the data from his 20 or so patients. There was just one problem. The relationship was not exact. It wasn't like every spring tide, every patient would go into mania, at least none that Tom had heard of. Until, that is, he heard about Michael. David, the psychiatrist from Seattle, had read about Tom's work, about this whole moon gravitational idea, and that prompted him to go back and check out the log that Michael had kept of his sleep patterns. And as it turned out, Michael was a perfect match. His mania fell on exactly the days of the bimonthly high tides or spring tides. For Tom, it was a validation for his theory. And for David, it was a thrilling chance to work with one of his scientific heroes.
There were all these complex rhythms, and Dr. Weir's brilliance comes from being able to recognize the lunar cycles within those patterns and making that connection.
They published a paper together in 2018 using Michael as their case study. In that paper, they put forward a possible explanation as to why it is that the moon's tidal cycle could be throwing off people's sleep schedules. It all goes back to a little gadget in our brains called the circadian pacemaker. It's basically like our internal clock. It governs not only when we sleep and wake up, but all of our biological processes. When we get hungry, when we have energy, the release of different hormones. And the thing that sets the internal clock is the sun, or more specifically, light. Or at least that's the way it's supposed to work. Here's Tom again.
There is some evidence that people who have bipolar illness, these clock mechanisms run a little bit slower.
Once someone's internal clock falls out of sync with the sun, it becomes vulnerable to syncing up with something else, namely the gravitational pull of the moon. But the clock doesn't uncouple from the sun completely.
It's sort of a battle between the sun and the moon for control of the system.
Tom and David published their studies in the journal Nature. And while the theory contradicts common wisdom about the moon and human behavior, the bipolar experts I talked to said the study seemed sound. As for Michael, he features prominently in the study. And he says for him, getting on a regular sleep schedule changed his life.
I was really disciplined because I was scared that whatever was going on in my head was going to be permanent and that this was my only weapon against it.
He also says the findings offered him a sense of redemption.
It's hard to describe. I don't know how to say it in a way that people would understand. It personally, for me, restored a lot of my faith in God because I was in such a dark period of time. And I cried out to God. And he sent me Dr. Avery. He helped me get out, and when Avery contacted me and said, I'm writing this paper, I found this data, and you're going to help so many people. I thought, I understand, Lord, why I had to go through this. And I hope that that's the purpose of it.
As for his very special relationship with the moon,
I will have to admit, I mean, last night was pretty smoky around here with all the fireworks and cloudy, but every now and then the moon would peek out, and I did catch myself every now and then looking at the moon going, huh, I wonder.
For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In the spring, the full and new moons seem to call an orgy to the beaches along the east coast of North America. It happens from Maine to the Yucatan Peninsula, but the Delaware Bay in New Jersey and Delaware is the epicenter of it all. Steph Yin went to witness this spectacle at a beach in Stone Harbor, New Jersey.
It's a night for romance at the beach. Everything is swaddled in a blue satin light. The waves are liquid silver, churning and tumbling to shore. The tide is high, thanks to a full moon.
I mean, we are walking on the beach and we do not have headlamps on. You can see.
And what we are seeing are bodies piled across shore, writhing in a frenzied mating ritual, right there in the sand and surf.
Oh, yeah.
We see some here that are mating. There seems to be a ton of them here.
Like how many?
An uncountable number.
All right, before your mind wanders too far down the gutter, these are horseshoe crabs. Every spring, tens of thousands of them come to the Delaware Bay for the biggest sex party of its kind. The creatures seem prehistoric, and they are. Horseshoe crabs were around more than 100 million years before the dinosaurs, and they've largely stayed the same, which is why scientists sometimes call them living fossils. They look sort of like combat helmet meets frying pan meets extraterrestrial.
They are total aliens.
They look like something from Doctor Who, I have to say.
Multiple times through its life, a horseshoe crab will wriggle a soft body out of its outer shell, grow and harden into a larger version of its former self. Through these moltings, the animals can get quite big, especially the females. They can be as long as your arm and weigh more than a medium-sized bowling ball.
So here's a really big female. She's huge.
Horseshoe crabs have a dozen legs and 10 eyes, which on moon-soaked nights like this one take in lots of light. That plus powerful pheromones emitted by the females help male horseshoe crabs find a mate. When the spring high tides strike, the crabs know it's time to spawn. They swim and crawl to shore, powerhouse females towing chains of smaller male suitors behind them.
It's amazing how these females just tow like 10 males with her.
Yeah, it's crazy. They're already heavy, and then they're carrying all that extra.
Brittany Morey, a research associate for a local nonprofit called the Wetlands Institute, says one way to tell males and females apart is that the males have a pair of modified front claws. The shape of the claw helps the males hitch a ride.
So they use that to latch onto the female's shell, and they have a little groove here, so it's kind of like a puzzle, so that he fits on her shell.
Once they've made it to shore, the females dig themselves into the sand, right near the surf, and deposit thousands of tiny green eggs. The surrounding males release their sperm.
The wave action mixes it with the eggs being laid by the female, and that fertilizes them, obviously. And then as she is finished, she crawls out, and the sand fills in around the eggs.
That's Bill Hall, a retired marine biologist who used to work for the University of Delaware. In the 1990s, Bill helped pioneer something called the quadrat protocol, a method for counting horseshoe crabs. Around that time, horseshoe crabs were experiencing a drastic dip in population, and scientists wanted a reliable way to monitor their numbers. The animals were threatened by two practices that still happen today. Fishers use the crabs as bait, and the biomedical industry uses lots of horseshoe crab blood for medical testing. It has a chemical in it that reacts when it comes into contact with harmful bacteria. When horseshoe crabs are overharvested, that has cascading effects because their eggs are food for fish, turtles, and migratory shorebirds. Today, there's a moratorium on harvesting horseshoe crabs in New Jersey and harvest limits in other states, including Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. But still, it's important to keep track of their numbers. As we walk down the beach, researchers Brittany Morey and Sam Collins from the Wetlands Institute are holding a square meter quadrat made of thin PVC pipe. Along every 10-meter stretch, they plop it down in the surf at a random point, then count and identify the sex of every crab that falls in the square. After a kilometer, we end up with 100 data points. On our walk back to our starting point, we flip over horseshoe crabs that have gotten stranded on their backs or stuck behind some kind of jetty, grass, rock, or rubble. If they can't flip over or get unstuck before the tide goes back out, the crabs will likely dry out and die on the beach.
There you go, off you go.
One volunteer, Amy Swanson, still remembers the magic of a field trip to the Wetlands Institute in high school and seeing the horseshoe crabs for the first time. In the more than two decades since, she's wanted to return.
It just feels like my whole life has come full circle because of it. It's that revisiting, I mean, it was 1993, 94 when I came down, and getting to all these years later come back to something like this is pretty special, and it feels really nice to be able to go back to my childhood in a really good way.
It must have made such an impression on you back then.
Oh my gosh, yeah, very much so, because we were kind of like an inner city school that I went to, and getting to see stuff like this up close and getting to have the hands-on experience was very fascinating. I know it drove a lot of us to actually go into the science careers.
All around in this group of 10 volunteers who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, there are many moments of revisiting, of tapping into childlike joy and curiosity.
Crab race, go now that way, the other way. Come on, you can do it, you can do it.
Here, watching heaps of sex-crazed horseshoe crabs slither under the full moon, it is easy to tap into something underneath the trappings of our modern lives. Sue Slaughterback, an educator with the Wetlands Institute, says when she takes school groups out, she likes to do a little ritual at the end.
I try to have the kids turn their lights off and just stand there at the edge of the water, and you can hear the crabs shifting back and forth with the water coming over them. And just have the kids think about that they are here at this moment witnessing something that's been going on since before the dinosaurs were here. And will probably be going on way after we're gone. Realize that this life that we have, to be here and see these sunsets and see these moonrises and horseshoe crabs and birds flying. This is a precious thing that we have.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. We're talking about the moon on the pulse. There's often this sense of eternity you get when you're looking at the moon, of being small in a big, vast universe. And when you watch an eclipse, lunar and especially solar, those feelings of awe and wonder are amplified. But now imagine witnessing an eclipse and having no clue what's happening.
If this is something you didn't see coming, and all of a sudden the moon goes dark, the sun goes dark, this is going to be pretty shocking.
Jonathan Seitz is a professor of history at Drexel University in Philadelphia. He studies ancient cultures like the Mesopotamians, who lived in parts of modern-day Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. He says the Mesopotamians learned how to predict solar and lunar eclipses.
If you watch things over a long enough time, you start to identify the patterns. And first maybe you realize that a solar eclipse can only happen at the new moon, because that's when the moon is in between us and the sun. And then you realize that the moon actually moves up and down, sort of above and below the sun, and you track that cycle. And so then you can figure out there are only certain new moons where it's going to be more or less in the right place to cause that eclipse.
For the Mesopotamians, the moon was the basis of their calendar. And even though they were able to predict when an eclipse would take place, they weren't able to explain why it was happening.
The eclipse, for the Mesopotamians, a lunar eclipse, they were really interested in the moon in particular. And a lunar eclipse was generally a bad sign for the king. And so it was something that would, maybe portend a rebellion or the death of a king or something like that. But it wasn't causal, and it wasn't inevitable. It was a message from the gods that you, the king, need to take some action. So maybe that means calling out the military. Maybe that means performing rituals, probably both, in order to try to prevent those potential bad things from happening.
Jonathan says many ancient cultures tried to interpret the meaning of eclipses, or maybe put a little bit of spin on them. Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, wrote about one such example.
At the beginning of the Persian Wars, the Persian Emperor Xerxes is about to head out to try to conquer Greece. And just when they're going to do this, there's a solar eclipse. And he's a little bit panicked, so he asks his astrologers what's going on here. And his astrologers assure him that this is no problem whatsoever, because the moon is his sort of astrological symbol, and the sun is the Greeks. And so it was a solar eclipse. The moon was shadowing the sun, eclipsing the sun. That represents his eventual victory over the Greeks. It didn't turn out that way. And I don't think Herodotus tells us what happened to the astrologers. Probably nothing good.
And then when do we make the shift toward the full understanding of eclipses, the way we look at them now and the way we can predict them and get excited about them weeks in advance?
I think the sort of stripping away of the significance happens in the sort of the early modern period in the 1600s and the 1700s. A good example of the turning point where the astronomer Edmund Halley, the comet is named after him, he is working kind of on behalf of the new English king, George I, who had been crowned the year before, and there was going to be this series of solar and lunar eclipses. And Halley was kind of worried, it seems, that there was going to be either possibly an astrological problem, but maybe more likely a social problem, that people would think there was an astrological problem about the royal family. And so he produced maps and tried to kind of propagate the idea that this is a perfectly natural event. We can show where it's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and therefore it really has no meaning for the king.
Jonathan Seitz is a professor of history at Drexel University in Philadelphia. For millions of Muslims around the world, the moon determines the beginning of two important religious rituals. And some say science could make the timing of those rituals much more exact. Hiba Fisher has more.
Astronomy plays a big role in Islam because Ramadan, the month where Muslims fast, and Hajj, the annual pilgrimage, are determined by changing lunar cycles.
All these religious activities are completely tied to cosmic times. To where is the sun and where is the moon?
Nidal Gassoum is from Algeria. He's Muslim and teaches at the American University of Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates.
You see, Islam wanted always people to have some connection with not only God, but with the rest of creation.
Ramadan and Hajj begin when the crescent of the new moon can be seen in the night sky. Often, there's a committee of people literally standing on a hilltop looking up at the sky. Sometimes it's cloudy and hard to actually see the crescent, so the start signal might be different based on where you are in the world. This all makes it so that Muslims often have just a few hours' notice ahead of when they're going to be fasting from food and drink. And it's typical to eat a large meal before you fast, so families stock up with food, but you don't know on which day you'll need it. The whole night before the possible start of fasting, people constantly refresh their mobile phones, looking for an announcement.
It creates differences and disagreements and arguments and people going, oh, the other mosque, they have decided to do this, but our mosque. And so that lack of balance between the temporal affairs and the religious spiritual affairs is really something significant to address.
Many Muslim countries give a whole week off for Hajj, but you can't book a trip in advance because you don't know which dates the holiday will fall on. For lots of us, modernity basically means that you can schedule everything in your life. In these two instances, you can't. But astronomers tell us, actually, there is a way to plan ahead.
I can tell you 200 years from now, you know, at what time people should be praying in Zimbabwe. Because it's equations. Just solve the equation and put the time 100 years from now. Just put T, you know, replace T in the equation. For us, like, what's the big deal? Really, for the scientists, like, it's no big deal. It's just another value for T.
So if it's that easy, why don't all Muslims follow this? Right now, only three countries, Turkey, Bosnia, and Albania, calculate the start of Ramadan and Hajj in advance. The rest of the Muslim world, we keep refreshing our phones. And I wondered, why is that?
Because the religious scholars are still adamant that we need to follow the hadith, which says, fast when you see the crescent.
A hadith is a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, like guidelines. In this instance, the guidelines say, fast when you see the crescent. So religious scholars interpret this as, well, we have to wait and see.
Yeah, but that was because 1400 years ago, there was no other way. But I say, if you bring the prophet today and I show him all my calculations, do you think he says, yeah, that's really nice, but let's wait until we see the crescent? He's not going to say that.
As Nadal says, the prophet was known for promoting whatever was easiest for people. But what makes this entire debate tricky is the confrontation between literalist interpretations of holy scripts, or tradition, and modernity. For astrophysicist Nadal Gassoum,
this balance, I think, is fundamental. That you want your spirituality and your worldly life to go together. And so now all we're doing, we the Muslim astronomers, is trying to sort of balance it again, to reconcile this with this, try to find what is the optimal solution that still preserves the culture, but at the same time, they fit.
That story was reported by Hiba Fisher. She is the co-host of the Middle East podcast, Kerning Cultures. Over the millennia, the moon has inspired scientists and thinkers to push boundaries, to figure things out. In the case of an exclusive club in England,
Lunar Society in Birmingham in the Midlands of England,
the moon lent its name and its light to fuel important discussions. Here's David Warmflesh. He's the author of a new book called Moon, An Illustrated History.
This was a group of people, of thinkers, in the late 18th century, they got together once a month at the home of Matthew Bolton, an industrialist, when it was a full moon. And the reason why it's called the Lunar Society, why they got together when there was a full moon, simply to have light, to be able to get home safely at night. They weren't trying to go to the moon or anything like that. But what they did do is they were brainstorming about technology that really would bring in the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution did get started in that part of England. And there were people there who got it going. In addition to Matthew Bolton himself, there was Erasmus Darwin, who was the grandfather of Charles Darwin. James Watt, the inventor of the steam engine, was also part of the Lunar Society of Birmingham.
David says the ideas of these thinkers and the Industrial Revolution eventually helped get us to the moon.
Because without the Industrial Revolution, we would not have advanced so quickly over the past two or three centuries since then. It was the Lunar Society, and also nearly a century before, the moon had, of course, inspired Isaac Newton to his gravitational theory. And in order to make gravitation work, Newton had to invent calculus. He wasn't the only one who invented it, but he was one of the two people inventing calculus in that time period, and the Industrial Revolution totally depended on calculus. You couldn't have had that expansion of steam power in the 19th century with trains and big factories without calculus, and you certainly could not have had rocket propulsion. And this is arguably what enabled the space race and getting people to the moon.
David Warmflesh is an astrobiologist and the author of Moon, an Illustrated History.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I was recently at a big wine tasting, and everybody seemed super excited about something called biodynamic wines. And it turns out the moon plays a starring role in this approach to agriculture. Andrew Stelzer visited biodynamic growers to learn how this works and what the moon has to do with it.
Sonoma County, California. Along with neighboring Napa, this is the legendary wine country. General stores selling fancy cheeses, a mix of tractors and expensive cars driving around bucolic winding roads, and row after row of pristine manicured grapevines. But the vineyard I'm visiting is a little bit different. Thick, tall grasses and wildflowers cover the ground. I have to wade through them just to get close to the vines.
We're in a Cabernet block right now, Cabernet Sauvignon, and the caps are sitting on the clusters. They're still developing.
Daphne Amory is my guide here. She's a consultant for Eco Toronto Vineyards. They brought her in 5 years ago to help them convert a traditional winemaking site into a biodynamic operation.
When we first started doing this, the buyers of the grapes would come out, and when they first saw this, it was funny. They said, "Why are all those weeds out there? What is going on?"
What looks like a bunch of weeds is actually a carefully chosen mix of more than a dozen varieties, including clovers, poppy, pea, and rye. The flowers were selected to enrich the soil and enhance the quality of the grapes growing a few feet away. Eco Toronto also brings chickens into the vineyard to eat bugs, fertilize the soil, and move the dirt around. To get biodynamic certification, you first have to meet certified organic standards. Then come the additional requirements. Annual crops can't be planted in the same field for more than 2 years in a row. Pest control solutions should be manufactured from natural materials found on site. As little as possible should be imported from outside the farm.
All of the tenets of biodynamics, I mean, all the practices, it's good farming.
The theory is that the farm is an interconnected organism. Everything you need is here, and everything, absolutely everything, has to be taken into account, including that big silver disc in the sky.
This is where it starts to sound really woo-woo, because there's so much behind this.
So think about the moon's gravitational pull. Amory says when the moon is almost full, it's time to plant seeds, because the moon's gravity will help pull the sprouts upwards. When it's a new moon, that's a good time for root systems to grow down into the ground. They won't have to fight as hard against the moon's gravity.
So when I'm working with a moon cycle, I'm working with where's that plant that I'm working with at that moment in that cycle.
Farmers all over the world have been planting by the phases of the moon for thousands of years. But there hasn't been much scientific research done on this. More than a decade ago, Cristiano de Mello Gallup was studying soil pollutants in Germany. In one experiment, his team unexpectedly noticed a pattern of day-to-day and monthly growth cycles in the control group of their plants. After scratching their heads for a while, they figured out that those cycles matched up with the tides. And the tides, of course, are dictated by the moon.
We usually found that after 2 or 3 days after the full moon and the new moon, we have more growth in our samples.
They replicated the experiment in Japan, the Czech Republic, and Cristiano's home country of Brazil. Each time, both wheat and mung bean seeds responded to tidal variations. This doesn't prove that the moon's gravity can pull a plant upwards as it grows or aid its roots in lurching downward, but those lunar cycles could have some sort of impact.
It means that we must consider forces that are everyday in life, that people are not considering, like gravity.
Cristiano says he personally prefers eating biodynamically grown rice. He's not totally sure why, but says it just tastes better and he feels better after eating it. And for food producers, that consumer satisfaction is ultimately what counts.
I mean, I recognize that it sounds very out there. If anything, it's a jumping off point to start talking about what's in your wine, you know, and what's in your food.
In Oakland, about 2 hours south of Cloverdale, Nick Johnson is 15 feet up on a ladder, leaning over a 130-gallon oak barrel. He's using a giant eyedropper to suck me out a sample of some biodynamic Pinot Grigio.
What sits in the valve is never very good, so I purge that.
Nick and his partner moved their wine bottling operation here to Oakland last year. Their company, Tintype Wines, is part of a small but thriving biodynamic wine scene. He says if people knew how many pesticides or chemicals end up in conventional wines, they wouldn't be so happy.
I think there's this huge disconnect. I think a lot of people are, you know, drinking really chemical industrial wine with their farmer's market dinner.
Biodynamic products are also on the pricey side. Tintype's wines sell for between $20 and $30 a bottle. Just like organic food, it may take a while before moon-grown produce becomes affordable enough to hit the mainstream.
That story was reported by Andrew Stelzer. Earlier on, we heard from astronomy professor Annette Lee, who is Lakota, and she was telling us about the tradition of naming moons according to the time of year and the seasons. Here are some more examples.
So there's maple sap boiling moon, there's strawberry moon, there's ricing moon. One of my favorites, hard crust on the snow moon, or in Lakota we have sore eyes moon. And it has to do with when, like a late in winter when the top layer of the snow melts, but then it melts during the day, but it refreezes at night. And so sometimes this is also the time when the snowshoes can be broken because of that sharp crust of ice.
Annette says she often hears people using these names for the moon and tying them to the farmer's almanac without mentioning their origins in Native American cultures.
I think it's really important, instead of quoting a source like, for example, the farmer's almanac, which is really coming from, you know, a kind of a corrupted source from the white European perspective, a colonizer perspective of what the Native American traditions were. And it's really a sort of an oversimplification, because you have to imagine there's over 500 tribes. So every tribe is going to have different moons for each month, whatever their cultural traditions are, right? So I think what we can do is, as we go down this path of, you know, being more culturally fluent and culturally agile, we can be more respectful. Instead of just saying, oh, strawberry moon, we could say this, you know, this comes from the Ojibwe tribe and it's this month, and other tribes have different ways of knowing and different moon months.
Annette Lee is a professor of astronomy and physics at St. Cloud State University in Minnesota. We've been talking about different ways in which the moon impacts our lives here on Earth. Its light, its gravitational pull, and there are all these beliefs around the moon changing behavior in humans and animals. For example, wolves. Do they really howl at the moon? Kate Morgan has more.
Legends about wolves and the moon can be found anywhere from Norse mythology to fables, fairy tales, and X-Men comic books. The Innu tribe from Quebec has the story of Kuakuatsu. Kuakuatsu lived in the spirit world, and he was in love with the moon. Luckily for him, the moon loved him back. Every night when she went out to shine on the mortal world, Kuakuatsu would watch her in awe. Another spirit named Trickster was jealous of their love, so he came up with a plan to get Kuakuatsu out of the picture. Trickster told Kuakuatsu that the moon deserved a beautiful gift, the wild roses she could see from the sky every night. Kuakuatsu thought this was a great idea, so he went to the mortal world and gathered the roses. But he forgot something important. Once you leave the spirit world, you can never go back. In mourning for her lost love, the moon bestowed a gift on Kuakuatsu. She turned him into a wolf. Now, when the full moon shines, Kuakuatsu, the wolf, sings to her. It's a great story, but Michelle Mancini, the educational coordinator at the Wolf Sanctuary of Pennsylvania, likes to separate fact from fiction.
I think it's actually, of course, people putting that impression on them. I think people have a fascination with the moon. I think they have a fascination with wolves as well. So the two kind of combined into fairy tales.
In fact, the middle of the night is when you're least likely to hear a wolf howl.
Wolves are actually not truly nocturnal animals. They don't have eyesight at night like a bat or another species that would have super great eyesight at night, you know, the really big eyes. They actually can see better during the day. They typically hunt at dawn and dusk. It's called crepuscular as opposed to nocturnal or diurnal.
There are 53 wolves here at the sanctuary, many rescued from people who tried to keep them as pets, breeding programs, and defunct zoos around the country. They live in large, naturally wooded enclosures where they can dig dens, swim in ponds, and chase the occasional unfortunate rabbit. And they make lots of noises, for lots of reasons.
Barking for wolves is an alert, so it's kind of like a, who are you, what are you doing here? It was an alarm call. She was concerned that we just arrived in the morning.
Most of the time, wolves howl to locate members of their own pack or to intimidate potential enemies.
So they'll often vary the pitch of their howl when they're howling together, and that will actually make it sound like there's twice as many wolves in the pack as there are. So ideally, it would mean that, you know, anybody hearing them, any neighboring packs might not want to challenge them because that's their territory.
Howls can also be an expression of sadness.
They can do a mourning howl if they're alone, say if their pack has abandoned them for some reason, or if they lose a mate. Here we've had wolves howl, a lone howl at losing a companion, sometimes for, you know, a short period of time, but sometimes it can last for weeks to months, where they'll howl kind of a daily lone howl in mourning. They do grieve.
For the most part, Michelle says, the belief that wolves howl at the full moon is a misconception. But that's not to say it doesn't contain a kernel of truth.
Under the light of the full moon, they're more likely to be more active at night, and also they're more likely to succeed at hunting when they go out. And when they succeed, they might gather as a pack and howl together to both mark their territory and also strengthen pack bonds, and they're also really excited because they've succeeded at getting some prey, getting some dinner.
So no, they're not howling at the moon, but they may be howling because of it.
Kate Morgan reported that story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Andreas Copes is our intern. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and this week we had engineering assistance from Diana Martinez. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.